in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Back about 10 minutes into hour two on this Tuesday, and we can qualify this visit with Dr. Palmer. We can file it under Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn. Not every horse health visit has to be Dr. Alday. In this case, it's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to have Dr. Scott Palmer join us, who is, of course, the equine medical director for the state of New York, and kind of an exciting project that seems to be gaining a lot of notoriety and a lot of momentum. First of all, we'll say good morning, Dr. Palmer.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me this morning. It's always a pleasure.
Well, and, you know, there's been, I think, a series of visits with you over the last, let's call it, 5 to 7 years. And it seems like each time we're talking, there's been improvement in the landscape. And, you know, if we consider 2010 the jumping off point, when there was the first prominent recognition of a spate of injuries and fatalities, and every time there's been anything along these lines, that we've had terrific improved measures, essentially. And I think about what's gone on with the Mid-Atlantic plan to reduce injury and fatality, what's gone on in California. And here's a project that kind of fits the advanced warning system concept, basically getting out in front of potential injuries and anything that the horse is potentially projecting as an area of concern before it becomes an actual injury.
Well, that's right, Steve. And for many years, our focus has been on identifying horses that are increased risk of injury because for more than 20 years now, research has shown that a lot of the horses that experience catastrophic injuries have pre-existing conditions. And while that knowledge is extremely important, the real challenge is to detect those conditions before they become serious. And I think we've worked hard, as you say, over the years to reduce fatalities, and we've got the fatality numbers down more than 40%, both in New York and in all the Mid-Atlantic region right now, which is a terrific accomplishment. But there's only so much you can do with subjective evaluations. And what I mean by that is these are, you know, veterinarians examining horses before races and in between races, and blood testing for medications. There's just a lot of things that we've done, but we're limited by the subjective quality of that data. And we've always known we need to do better. So I think that what we're looking at now is basically a project that is evaluating the use of biometric wearable sensors to identify horses at increased risk for injury. And it's really exciting because I have to say that this is probably the most promising technology I've seen in the last 10 years that's going to enable us to do better, to head things off at the pass so we can identify a horse with a minor concern in time to address that concern without losing the horse to training or to a fatality. So I'm very excited about it.
It invariably, Dr. Palmer, whenever there's been added heightened scrutiny of spates of injury, it seems that, you know, the change in condition, and essentially that means the racetrack, is a contributing, a major contributing factor, and then there's other ambient areas, the condition book, and you know, all the things that you know, that you and Alan Foreman and Jerry Bailey and the, you know, the aqueduct study identified. I mean, that was really the first comprehensive you know, flare that went up in this arena. It seems that, you know, the term, you know, microfracture or fissures in bone invariably is, you know, is the starting point. And explain how this concept and let's introduce, you know, the StrideMaster devices. How do they work? What are they sensing, essentially? You know, how do they work?
Well, first of all, I'd like to back up one step. You made mention of things like microfractures, and those are really serious problems that in a moment's notice can turn into a catastrophic injury. One of the things we've learned in the last 10 years, Steve, is that actually that's not where things start. The microfracture is pretty much near the end of the road. We need to identify problems much earlier than that. And these problems are musculoskeletal problems, but the fracture is really the end point. We need to be working in terms of, you know, what about the development, the proper development of strength and power in the hind limbs? And I'm going to talk to you about gait in a moment to put that in perspective. But the fact of the matter is we need to find a screening tool that gives us a flag that'll get a horse examined by a veterinarian, maybe some advanced imaging. There's a lot of technology that we can do to diagnose things, but this is not a diagnostic test, and I can't emphasize that more. You see, a screening tool, Steve, has to meet three criteria to be useful. The first criteria is it has to be readily available, okay? Everybody's got to have access to it. The second thing is that it's got to be accurate. We can't have a lot of false positives and false negatives in order to have a good screening tool. And finally, it's got to be affordable. And so this is not a tool to make a diagnosis. PET scans, MRIs, bone scans, things like that are diagnostic tools. And we talk about using them for screening, but to be honest about it, if by the time you see things on there, even with a PET scan, there's a significant amount of pathology that's already come down the road. And those are not screening tools. Those are diagnostic tools. And we really need a screening device to screen these horses, and that's why I'm excited about these biometric sensors. Now, a biometric sensor is, think of them as a Fitbit, only better. Biometric sensors are devices that they're wearable, they are non-invasive, they're relatively inexpensive, and they are the kind of thing that can give us the first sign of trouble. You know, that's what we're really after here. So these technologies in people, they're wristbands or skin patches. They collect biological, physiological, or behavioral data, and that's what we're doing here. Now, we're not collecting things like heart rate, respiratory rate, oxygen levels, nothing like that. This sensor is a GPS device, and what it does some remarkable things, Steve. It's the size of a cell phone, and it fits into the saddle cloth just like a Trackus device. In fact, in New York for the last, since Saratoga's meet last year, we've been putting them in horses and looking at them and learning quite a bit about this. But these devices transmit a signal to a satellite, and they use a sensor, a technology that's, we call it 800 hertz. That means it sends 800 bytes of information per second to a satellite. And there's three different sensors in there. One sensor that measures acceleration in the longitudinal vector. That means going front to back. And then there's another vector, and that's going up and down, and the third vector is side to side. So we have a three-dimensional signal that's going to a satellite 2,400 times a second, which tells us very accurately where that sensor is in time and space. Now, to put that in context, the typical sensors that are used to time races these days are accurate to about 1 meter. These sensors are accurate to 10 centimeters. So it's extremely accurate, very precise, and it tells us a lot about what's going on in there. Now, I want to take a second to talk to you about the horse's gallop. We've all seen pictures, slow motion films of horses galloping down a racetrack. And in my book, there's nothing more beautiful than that. The gait is a very complex thing, but we can, for purposes of analysis like this, break it down into three very simple parts. The first part of the stride begins with a hind limb stance phase. This is where the horse is bearing weight on the hind limbs and loading those limbs. And I want you to think of the hind limbs as gigantic springs. And these springs are being loaded with the horse's weight, which is at one point in the hind limb stance phase, it's all loaded onto one leg. And that's generally 3 or 4 times the body weight. So we're talking 3 or 4 thousand pounds of pressure on one leg while this horse is compressing the body weight down on that leg and then launching forward from the hind limb. So we're loading these hind limb springs and then pushing forward. That's phase one. Phase two is the forelimb stance phase. And what that is that's when the front legs catch the weight, if you will, of the body that's being propelled forward by the hind limb springs. So we're landing on those forelegs at that point in the stride, and that's a whole lot of weight being distributed on those legs. And then the final phase of the stride is the period of suspension. I'm sure you've all seen pictures of the horses literally flying over the racetrack with all four legs off the ground. And that time is when the horse can breathe. The horse takes a breath when he's in the air like that, you know, expanding his diaphragm. And then we start all over again. So these three phases of stride can be seen and described very accurately using the sensor. And we can see things happening during the stride that are very unique to individual horses. So I would say if you thought about it, when you see your friend of yours walking down the street, you may recognize him from some distance because the way he or she walks. Well, horses all have a way that they walk too. And the slow gaits are not good to analyze because there's a lot of noise in them. But when the horse gets going fast, and I'm talking about usually faster than 14 seconds per furlong. So these are horses that are generally going, a breezing horse is going about 13 seconds per furlong, a racing horse is going around 12. So when they're at that speed, though, the body just defaults back to the basic biomechanics of the animal, and they have a very consistent fingerprint, if you will, of what that gait looks like. Now, we can't document that with the naked eye, but we can with this technology. And so when these horses are wearing the sensor, they go out on the racetrack with the sensor on, we record their data through the race, and then that data is loaded into a computer, and I get a report back from the computer that tells me either if the horse has got a consistent, even gait that fits with the fingerprint that we're looking at, then that is a green light, like a traffic light. And if the horse is more than one standard deviation, up to 1.5 standard deviations away from what we think is the mean, then we get an amber alert. And then if we have a horse that deviates two or more standard deviations from that fingerprint, then that's a red alert. And that means that's a horse that we got to have a look at.
Huh.
So that's basically what we're getting with this information, and it's been extremely helpful. We're taking that information and comparing it with pre-race exam findings and epidemiologic data from the horses and interviews with the trainers. And we've been able to really find a lot of interesting things that can help us identify horses at risk and save lives. In fact, there was a great example of a horse at Saratoga this summer that we happened to get a recording on, just to give you some idea how sensitive this technology is. This horse raced at Saratoga, won the race. I'm sorry, he finished second in the race. And when he came back, he came back to the saddling area fine. The jockey was thrilled with the performance. The trainer was happy. Everybody was happy. That horse, because it finished second, was walked over from the unsaddling area about a quarter of a mile over to the test barn. When the horse got in the test barn, the horse was a little bit sore. The horse became lame, so lame, in the test barn, we had to ambulance him back to his barn after the race. Now, the horse was examined, and what was found, he was x-rayed, and he had developed a fracture in his right carpus. We actually saw that happen with the technology from the race. When we went back and looked at it, we could see dramatic changes in the horse's acceleration, dramatic shifts in weight about 58 seconds into the race. We knew exactly what had happened, but it was so subtle that the jockey didn't know anything happened. The trainer didn't know anything happened. The horse finished second. Everybody was happy. But this technology is sensitive enough for us to see things that the human eye just can't see and the jockey can't feel.
Amazing. A couple of things to that point. The obvious necessary portion of this is getting a baseline, right? You're going to have to get a base of a horse's healthy movement before you're going to then see a variant to that base.
Yes and no, Steve. You're right. We do need a baseline. But at Saratoga, when we first got started, we didn't have baselines on anybody. Right. So what we did was we had 256 horses in that group that we looked at. And with that number, we were definitely able to get a fingerprint, a normal fingerprint for the main dirt track. OK, so we had what do 256 horses look like when they go over that track at high speeds? And you know what? There's a lot of commonality, especially with a good quality group of horses. But they're not all the same, but there is commonality. So what we used at Saratoga was what we call a population mean or average. So we're not looking at a horse's history. We're looking at all of the horses and comparing an individual horse to all of the horses. And the horse that we found with the fracture was so far off the average of all the horses, we could see that he deviated from the baseline of the whole population. Now, here's the best part, that we can do even better. We can do better as we get more data, because if we get this technology on horses that train, we can get every single horse's fingerprint. And then when that horse goes to the racetrack, if there's even a subtle change, we'll pick it up, whereas we would not necessarily find it in the population mean. That makes sense?
Absolutely. Before I ask about the diagnostic portion, because I want to try to keep it in an orderly progression of conversation, what are the differences as potentially indicated by the surface, and that includes dirt track versus turf, and right. What about a different level of grooming in terms of the racetrack? I mean, in terms of a slow heavy track versus a tight fast track, and how can surface variance affect this?
Well, that's a great question, Steve. Now we're getting into a totally different area. We were talking so far about identifying horses at risk for injury, okay?
Yeah.
What this technology does, though, it tells us a whole lot more than that, and it can give us a lot of information about the racetrack. For example, for years when we did this, when we did the study at Aqueduct back in the winter of 2011-12, one of the things that we did was map out the location on the racetrack where all the horses experienced the injury. And we got a certain profile that's very consistent with a lot of racetracks. But the actual fact of the matter is we know that the horse's injury happened long before the horse was pulled up or fell down. And we can see that with this technology. We can see exactly on the racetrack, you know, when the injury took place. And how do we know that? It's because there's a major deceleration when a horse gets injured. In other words, they're going, you know, as fast as they can go pretty much or on the racetrack. But then if something goes sideways, the horse slows down. And we can see that with a change in the longitudinal acceleration. So we can pinpoint points along the racetrack, which we could never do before. It might give us a clue if we have a commonality that says, well, these horses are experiencing an injury at the top of the far turn and not in the at the eighth pole. We'll be able to take a more informed look at that racetrack and address any changes there. Now, another thing you mentioned, changes in track condition and turf and dirt. Obviously, these are very different things. And some horses, as you know, like to run on the dirt better than the turf, or they like to run on the turf better than the dirt. Now, that's not a difficult thing for trainers to figure out. But one of the things that we can do with this technology is I mentioned to you that we have three different force vectors or acceleration vectors that we're looking at. Well, we can measure basically the amount of power that the horse is putting out during the race. Let's call that the amount of effort, okay? And that has a lot to do with that hind limb spring. If the horse you could have a really great horse and a mediocre horse, both of them are going to finish a race in a minute and 10 seconds, but one horse has got to work a lot harder to do that than the other. So we can see that in the gait, and you can get a really good idea about whether a horse likes to run on the slop or whether he's better, you know, on a deep track or a hard track.
Right.
You know, we can see all those things with this sensor, and it can give us a lot of information about the racetrack and about the horses and how well they're doing on it.
Now this is going to get me. I'm going to go veering off when you say that, because there's parts of this that also can certainly come into play. Things like shoeing, right? Hoof angles and tinkering from the farrier side and the way. I mean, is it strictly a matter of how horses are hitting? And I guess this goes to the next step, which is the diagnostics. I mean, when you see a variable that the first thing I can think of is the sensors on my car now. I mean, these days where we get, you know, we get an email or a text when a tire starts to shudder. That I think feels like that kind of an akin concept. But where do we go, and what are the steps to then diagnose? And can we potentially fix things like hoof angle and so forth, and what a good farrier can do in terms of solving the soreness and the way a horse is hitting?
Well, yeah, Steve, let's say that we'll try and put this in context a little bit. First of all, remember, this is not a diagnostic tool. This is a scanning device. It's a screening device, okay?
Yeah.
So we're not trying to make a diagnosis, but by the same token, this is the point at which you want to try and catch things. You know, if we could catch an injury that's starting out just as and reflected in an abnormal gait, maybe the horse is having a really hard time in the turns versus a straightaway, for example, we can. That doesn't mean he's lame, and it doesn't mean he finishes the race with any obvious problem, but if we could identify that early on and get that horse examined by a veterinarian at the very least, that's a major step forward. I think when I think about putting this device in a context of the big picture of what do we do with this information, there's a couple of things, and then I want to share, remind me if I forget, but down the road, before we finish, I want to share you what I believe might be the future of this technology, which is pretty exciting and transformative, really, in its ability to help us out. But let's just say that my vision right now is if we can get these sensors on enough horses when they train that we can pick up things while they're training, you know, that can give us a clue that something's going on before they go out and actually race. Remember, when a horse trains, he's generally not going as fast as he races. Now, sometimes they do, of course, but generally speaking, those training workouts are shorter and slower than a race. Not by a lot, but by some degree. And if we can catch things early like that, we're going to be able to save some horses, that's for sure. Now, how do we diagnose the problem? Well, there's some other technology that's been out there for a number of years. I did some beta testing with some folks at the university, Dr. Keegan at the University of Missouri years ago, looking at this thing called a lameness locator. And what we're really talking about here, Steve, is moving from subjective evaluation into objective data gathering, okay? And so I can watch a horse jog, and I might say, well, that horse is grade 2 lame on a hard pavement. And you might watch that horse jog and says, Doc, you're crazy. That horse is sound. Well, that's subjective data. You know, I have an opinion, you have an opinion. We put lameness locator on this horse, and that tells us exactly with numbers, you know, what's going on in that horse's gait symmetry. And typically, I'll share with you that the big surprise for me before I became a regulator back in the 2010s through 2014, I was using this device in my practice on a regular basis. And the astonishing thing that I found at the time was I realized that racehorses more than not are lame in more than one leg. They're almost always lame in at least two legs, sometimes three, sometimes four. And we can't see that. We can't discriminate that with the naked eye, but the lameness locator can do that. So a combination, once we get the red flag and we get the horse looked at with a lameness locator or something of its kind, it doesn't have to be. You can just have a capable veterinarian doing a lameness diagnosis and nerve blocks. I mean, that works. But there's some limitations to that. And typically when we're doing nerve blocks, well, the horse might be obviously lame in the right front leg. We block that leg, and now he's lame in the left front leg. And that was the tip-off that I had known for years about contralateral limb lamenesses. But this lameness locator really takes that to another level. So there's a number of diagnostic tools. Once we get the idea that it's both front legs or it's the right front and the right hind or whatever it might be, then we go to advanced imaging. It could start with regular x-rays. Many times, though, those x-rays are normal. But that's when you start getting into things like a PET scan or a scintigraphy exam. Now, these things are not cheap. They're not scanning devices, but they can give us a diagnosis. So once we identify the limbs that we want to look at, then we can use this advanced imaging to see what's going on. And then we design a treatment plan based upon what we find there. Now, hopefully, if we find things early enough, our treatment plan is not really so in disruptive to the horse's career. For example, if we find an early challenge or early problem, a common thing is abnormal bone remodeling in the bottom of the cannon bones. We find that early enough, we can just give this horse some time out or back up in his training a little bit and get him back to the races, and he's totally fine. If we miss that opportunity and we only can diagnose that when it's in an advanced case, a lot of those horses are never normal again, Steve, and their economic engine is lost to the industry. It's really a problem if you catch it at the end of the road, but I'm confident that we'll be able to do that a lot earlier by scanning these horses and getting them a good diagnosis and then doing the appropriate treatment, and I think it's going to be a win-win for everybody.
I want, I've got follow up to that too, including, and do not let me forget to ask about how early in a horse's life, essentially. I mean, even into, you know, weanling, yearling type timing, I want to ask about and what potential there is to identify horses that probably shouldn't even point toward a racing career, but explain to everybody, because I haven't had a conversation about this with Dr. Alday in too long, but contralateral limb lameness and you know the whole concept of injury presenting itself in the opposite side and fore or hind, basically, you know, showing that there's an issue, but that's not where the problem really is. Explain to people how that works.
Okay, well, remember, now I'm going to go back to the gallop. Remember, we talked about the three phases of the gallop. We talked about the hind limb stance phase, the spring loading phase. We talked about they launch forward, land on the front legs, and then we had the period of suspension. A lot of these problems, I believe, starts with the back end, with weakness in the back end where they cannot properly handle the weight that's being loaded on those limbs. And this can lead to muscle soreness. It can lead to ligament problems, sacroiliac joints. There are a whole bunch of causes of lameness in the hind legs of thoroughbreds that, frankly, Steve, hadn't been diagnosed until the last, 15, 20 years. But a lot of the, before that, very few people actually ever looked at the hind leg of a thoroughbred racehorse because it was too doggone dangerous for the most part, and we couldn't figure out what was going on very well. It was easier, but the front leg was much easier to manage because that's more of an end-stage situation. Stuff is easier to see. You're seeing it later in the problem, right? And so it's the kind of thing where it's, the focus has always been on the front legs for the most part. But certainly veterinary medicine has caught up quite a bit in the last 10 years, and people are certainly looking at the hind legs of horses and understand that the front leg injuries are related to hind leg problems as well. So it's really, really important to look at put the whole thing in perspective and try and get away from just trying to find microfractures and things that are end stage problems, if you will. We got to find these things before they break. So that's why we have to change the paradigm a bit, and start thinking about the whole picture, about strengthening those horses' hind limbs, training them in such a way that their hind limbs are capable of withstanding the pressures here. And that gets into a whole other subject. When you talk about 2-year-olds in training, it's been a concern for a long time that horses are being conditioned when they're very, very young for these sales in a way that may not be the best way to go in the long run. I can remember, and when I was in practice many, many times, having horses come back from the sale and they had a really great work, at the 2-year-old training sale. The horse would have developed swollen ankles about a month later, and we just couldn't get those horses to the races for the longest time. So as to when this technology is applied, I'm not sure we have enough data to really say that we could do this to a weanling, but certainly as the horses start working, it can be used. And frankly, keep in mind that what we're talking about here is really Stride Safe, which is a portion of the company called Stride Master. And Stride Master was designed to help identify grade one horses. That technology was designed to pick out the efficient gates, the horses that are likely to be very successful. And it wasn't designed to exactly figure out or identify horses at risk of injury. That's a new development that Dr. David Lambert gets credit for, I believe, for taking that Stride Master technology and recognizing the potential for using it to identify horses with early gait abnormalities that can lead to injury. So it can be used very early in their life. Remember, though, I did say to you that it's not helpful at slow gaits. It's you only can really use it at high speeds because that's where the horse at slow gaits, there's so much going on, Steve, that it's hard to tell anything meaningful about it. It's not reproducible data, but it is very reproducible when the horses are going at high speeds.
The Stride Master, differentiate this concept from the heart measurement. Wasn't the original product a heart output measurement?
Well, there've been a number of companies working in this area, Steve, and I don't want to get into the weeds with that right now, but let's just say that there are companies that look at heart rate and respiratory rate. Basically, it's an exercise, and it's like a stress test, an exercise EKG over the ground, much like we have endoscopes now we can put in a horse and gallop them out on the racetrack and see what's going on, over the ground endoscopy. So those are different areas. But let's just say that the idea of looking at a racehorse with this GPS technology has been around for a very long time. And only recently has Dr. Lambert really refined it in a way with scientists from around the world. It's a very, you know, powerful research team, you know, that's been looking at this technology to put it, to find a way to use this technology to make racing safer.
From an execution standpoint, and I know that this I have an article from last April that literally has been in my, you know, in my potential conversation pile, and talked about the test that was conducted at Emerald, and you would think that, you know, at a track like Emerald, you know, with a certain class of runner, right, it would be a real acid test in terms of identifying at-risk horses. Of course, at the same time, you know, there is the axiom, Dr. Palmer, you know, the ones that go slow don't get hurt. You know, the idea that the entire population of a racetrack could be monitored with this, I mean, talk about the practicality, talk about the expense and the executional elements. I mean, who, you know, how costly, you sort of hinted at the expense, how costly is it, and what would go into, you know, making this part of the day-to-day operation of the tracks at NIRA, for instance?
Well, I want to step back and talk about Emerald Downs just a second. When David and I have been colleagues for more than 50 years. We both were practicing in New Jersey at racetracks 50 years ago.
And unbelievable.
I laugh about that because it just seems like it was only yesterday. But David went in one direction, I went in another, and we've circled back together on this project. So it's been a pretty exciting reunion, actually, that take David's expertise in the areas that he's been working in and me to bring to the table the expertise in my areas. And it's been very exciting. And one of the things I said to David, I need you to give me that data from Emerald Downs. I want to look at it. I want to, you know, put a little science to it and analyze and see, you know, what we're really looking at here. And because, again, before we did the study at Saratoga, we had no idea if we could even do this in a high operation tempo racetrack like Saratoga. And would it be different? Would the data be different? Because it is a different class of horse, obviously. But one of the things that we are doing right now, Steve, is looking at the data from all those Saratoga horses and following them. It's called a longitudinal study. When you identify horses at the beginning of a study, and then you follow them for a period of time and see basically what happens to them over a period of months. We can learn things from that. And, for example, how many of the horses that got alerts came back and raced in a timely fashion? Ordinarily, a thoroughbred racehorse races back about 34 days between races. Now, that's obviously an average mean, we call that, and it can vary quite a bit. But we were looking at data from the Emerald Downs horses, and a lot of those horses did not make it back to the races for 150 days. I thought to myself, holy smokes, that's a really long time. That means we must be really, something must be going on there. Now, nothing ruins your hypothesis like thorough research. So what I did was I said, well, we're not only going to follow the horses that got red alerts at Emerald Downs. We're going to follow some controls. We're going to pick horses from those races that had green lights and see what happened to them, you know, down the road. And lo and behold, they didn't come back to the races for 150 days either. And what I realized when I looked at the data and looked at the racing schedule at Emerald Downs, they closed that racetrack down.
Yeah, it's the meet. That's the season.
Yeah, so, you know, what I was looking at was not have anything to do with the horses being sowed or late. It had to do with the racing schedule at Emerald Downs, which made me laugh. But that's what you call a humbling moment, you know, an epiphany where you realize it's a reality check, okay? So we're doing that. Now, that's not true. When Saratoga's over, the horses don't go away for 150 days ordinarily, and we are looking at that data, and it's too preliminary to report back, but I will tell you that it looks a whole lot like we're seeing some real significant findings. We still need work to make that better. We're working right now to improve what we call the sensitivity and specificity of this test, if you will. And sensitivity and specificity basically means you want to not have too many false positives. You want to not have too many false negatives. You don't want to say that the horse is likely to get hurt when it's not. and you don't want to miss some that are likely to get hurt. You can't figure that out. So we're refining the technology as we go along, and it's getting better and better. I think it's we're learning all the time. We're working at it really hard to make sure that we want to be accurate in our prognostic capability to say that I want to be able to say to a trainer, you know, if your horse has a certain type of alert, now we're working on the types of alerts, refining that a bit, because remember I told you that these alerts are based on deviation of a horse from a mean, a standard deviation. A 2-standard deviation away from a mean is a big deal, but it could be either positive. That means that the total forces are high, or it could be negative, which means that the total forces are lower than they should be. And to be honest, that's the tricky part, because at Saratoga, as you know, we've got some really spectacular horses there. And those horses often will come up with a red alert on the negative side because they just don't have to try too hard. You know, they can just cruise out there and win. And, you know, that's going to give you a negative red, so that those negative reds are important, because if a horse is ordinarily in the positive area and then he drops to a negative area, that's a big deal. But if a horse is consistently low power and he can still be effective, that's a grade one horse. You know, so we don't want to stop with that one. So that's part of just a glimpse of some of the stuff we're working at to make this better. But the Emerald Downs experience was the first time that this study was ever done. And it was a great background, a pilot study, if you will, for us in Saratoga. We recorded, as I told you, about 256 horses at Saratoga. We recorded over 2,300 horses at Belmont Fall Meet. And so we're accumulating a lot of data and learning a lot very quickly.
Touch on the, I got two things. Touch on the expense portion and the practicality of applying this, franchise-wide, as it were. Think sure. About the summer, both at Saratoga and at Belmont. And I would imagine the value of this implicitly of horses coming back from injury and layoffs and basically horses that are put on the vets list and basically having to go through a monitored work to see if they've returned to the baseline.
That's right, Steve. That's obviously a really great application of this. But let's talk a little bit about, before we get into the cost per se, let's talk a little bit about value, okay? And the importance of being able to remember, I talked to you about the importance of a scanning device has to be available to everybody. You know, it can't be expensive. It has to be available to everybody. And, you know, think about, we talk about all the things that have been done in California and also in New York and other states as well, where horses are definitely being looked at more carefully, right? But, you know, I don't care how many veterinarians you have on the racetrack. And I don't care. You still don't have the objective criteria that we can get with this device. So, one of the things that's been bugging me for a long time is that we have been able to reduce the racing fatality in New York dramatically, more than 40% over the last 10 years. And in the Mid-Atlantic states, it's almost 44% or 48%. So, that's great, but, you know, the challenge has always been, how do you scale that so you can do it everywhere? You know, how do you make that work at the little racetracks and as well as the big ones? You know, how do you scale this thing, or how do you scale any kind of protective measure? We talk about risk factors, and then risk factors are mediated by protective factors. How can we use this as a protective factor? Because, frankly, it's super expensive. We don't even have enough veterinarians to look at all the horses before they breeze the way we'd like to. We just don't. There aren't enough of them around there. And believe me, sidebar, Steve, when you've got problems like we're experiencing in California right now with the California Horse Racing Board and the Veterinary Board of Examiners, don't think that there's a lot of veterinary students out there saying, oh, boy, I sure hope I can go and be a racetrack regulator, a racetrack practitioner.
Exactly.
You know, so we have a manpower problem. Now, but, if we can make this technology work and affordable, we won't need a whole bunch of veterinarians examining horses, because we'll have the data on them from these devices, and it's better than a veterinarian looking at the horse. It just is. And so, You know, there's a place for veterinarians out there, absolutely. Don't get me wrong. It's not a robot that can take the place of veterinarians, not in a million years. But it's an important adjunct piece, and it's important that we use it in the right way. So given that, how do we get this thing in the hand of all the trainers? How can we get it affordable? You know, these are things that we're working on right now. There's negotiations going on, and it's not the kind of thing we're going to talk about on your radio show. But let's just say that it's critical that we find a path forward where this technology can be inexpensively and used by every horse every time it goes out and works at speed. When we get to that point, we're going to make an enormous difference in identifying horses at risk and staging interventions and evaluating them to come back off the vets list. That's a fairly simple thing to do, and we could do that right now. But the point is, though, that to make the significant impact that we need to do across the country, and HESA is obviously going to take over in July. And believe me, there's no way that this technology is going to be mandated by HESA right now. HESA's job is enormously difficult, and they're trying to establish safety regulations that can be applied to every racetrack in form of accreditation. And certainly, you know, this kind of technology is not ready for that just yet, but it will be. It will be. And when it is ready for that, HESA has the ability to mandate this sort of thing. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of work to do here, Steve, and I don't mean to take up your time with a lot of long-range things, but this is something that is part of the future. I did mention to you I have a vision for a way that this technology could really be useful. I love the analogy that you used. I think you were referring to something like a check engine light in your car.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now just imagine. Remember I told you I get the report back from the computer within minutes of the race, okay? And we are constantly refining the interpretation of the data to give us more accurate alerts. So we're not giving false information to anybody. Okay. Now, also, this kind of technology lends itself to the use of artificial intelligence. Now, I want you to just put that in your imagination and think about the day when a rider is going to have a band underneath the visor of his helmet with a green light in it, a yellow light in it, and a red light in it. And as that jockey's going around the racetrack, if that green light turns to yellow, it's the caution light. If it turns to red, you pull the horse up. Now, that's got obvious regulatory implications, a whole lot of issues with that. But I could foresee it. Remember we talked about the horse getting injured before he actually falls down or breaks his leg. If a horse gets a crack in his bone in the middle of the backstretch and he goes for another quarter of a mile on that leg before he actually falls down, think of if we could just pull him up when it first happened, we could probably save those horses. You know, that's a stretch. And this is not science fiction, but it is a long way down the road. But I think this technology has unbelievable potential in terms of use of artificial intelligence and real-time analysis.
It sounds like the logical, you know, next step, and I suppose if you fold in the sensor scanning the scanning equipment that Santa Anita was adding, for identification of hot spots, the combination of all the advancing technologies together, Dr. Palmer, have got to have the potential to, you know, further just keep, drilling down here.
Absolutely. We're doing a project. This StrideSafe stuff is part of a project we're doing at Cornell, which is called Multimodal Screening to Identify Horses at Risk of Injury, and it includes things like blood tests for markers of bone inflammation and cartilage injury. It includes using the StrideSafe. It includes using imaging such as MRIs, body scans, we don't have a PET scan now, but we'd like to get one. But, I mean, that's a really good device. CAT scans are really good, too. So, I mean, you know, the combination of an early warning system with advanced imaging and, attentive people that are looking at these horses is the key, and it's going to be great. So I think it's the way of the future, and believe me, I wish it could happen faster, but it's taken us 10 years to get to this point, and it's just a really exciting transformational moment when we can get this right and, you know, move on with it and make it available to as many people as possible.
No, delighted to be able to get the details. I know tomorrow there's a seminar for the horsemen in New York that NYTHA is putting on, and again, explaining that Glenn Kozak first saw a presentation, probably one of Dr. Lambert's presentations, and brought it back, and Dave O'Rourke gave the big enthusiastic go get it, and let's try to be out in front of it. And to kind of harken back to something that came up earlier this morning with Michael Bacik, I again want to tie this kind of advancement to the cognizance of the issue, and this you could fold in things like the creation of the equine injury database. The industry wasn't even keeping track of fatalities, and the advancement of necropsies on every single horse that goes wrong. There's been so many incremental improvements in this in a very short period of time. It's literally since 2010 is when the clock started ticking on this and the awareness, and there's been a quantum advance. And so the notion that the industry doesn't respond to crises and to issues and come up with viable action plan executions, this is an example that is an unfair critique, and it should be held up on a going basis. Lecture over.
Steve, I think that's a great point. And one of the things I like to say about this technology is people ask me, well, you know, what are the benefits of this? Well, the benefits are obviously we save lives. We also save horses to keep them training and racing so that we can improve the business model of thoroughbred horse racing so we don't have such a high attrition rate, which we do right now. Yep. And finally, you know, when you think about it, the Philadelphia Inquirer in March 25th of 2021 published an article that basically referred to horse racing and said that the killing is built into the system. That's the narrative that we have been struggling with. You know, that's the media that we've been dealing with for a long time. That didn't start in 2021. That's been around for a long time. Well, we with this technology, we can change the narrative to the killing is inevitable. The narrative is that thoroughbred horse racing in New York is now using state-of-the-art biometric technology to take the horse and rider safety to the next level. Now, that's priceless. You know, that's a big deal. And so that's the big picture, you know, in terms of public perception and reaching out to the general public and creating, telling them the truth about all that we're doing. Now, a lot of the stuff that we're doing is still formative. But you're right. We've made tremendous progress in many, many areas. Glenn Kozak and I go back a long way. We met at Pimlico the day that Barbaro got hurt. And Glenn and I have been close friends ever since. And when Glenn came up to work in New York, we've been working together for years on racetrack maintenance and trying to figure out problems on the racetrack. And Glenn and I were really, along with Mick Peterson, folks that figured out what was going on at Saratoga in the beginning of the meet, 2017. So, yeah, there have been a whole lot of really great things that have happened. And I don't think we really blow our horn very often about this, but I think that right now this technology does represent, you know, again, transformational change that is going to be really, really helpful for us and for every racing jurisdiction. I can tell you that there are already a number of jurisdictions that have reached out to me and want to know if they can be a part of this research study, but I tell them right now that we're still in the formative stages of refining it, and there'll be a time when we can reach out and it'll be a broad application. But right now, we just want to make sure we've got a really good, indicator, a really good flag that means something significant. When we get that, then there'll be a major effort to put this in a context where everybody can use it at very little cost. And I do believe it's possible. That's not a stretch. But there's all kinds of economic levers we can pull to make that happen. But I think that right now we're still refining the research. I'm thrilled that people are interested in this and they recognize the potential of it. and it's sort of a no-brainer when you think about it. And so it's exciting to see it gain in popularity. I think it's going to be widely applied in the future, no question about it.
Outstanding. Well, we'll continue to report on it and provide updates I haven't had Dr. Lambert on in ages, so there's all kinds of potential follow-up. For now, Dr. Scott Palmer, thanks as always, and thanks to Naira for advancing this and the commitment to making the racing as safe as possible and doing everything we can to monitor the athletes and get out ahead of potential problems. Dr. Palmer, thank you.
Thank you, Steve. It's always a pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Dr. Scott Palmer, everybody, who is the State of New York's Equine Medical Director, has been serving the industry for decades and has been just a fabulous resource. It's actually been too long since we've had Scott on, so that was great. Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn. Going to take a break, last of the morning, and when we come back, Andy Serling is going to join us and get to more congratulations. We had congratulations for the NHC Hall of Famers, Andy being recognized by the chaplaincy, and I'm going to embarrass him by saying nice things about him. Then later in the hour, Ned Toffee is going to join us from Spendthrift. And of course, Leslie's lady, Fred Mitchell, and his late wife, Clarkland Farm. But for Spendthrift, obviously, for Wayne Hughes during his life and tenure and till his passing, what Leslie's lady did for Spendthrift, you can't even measure what Beholder and Into Mischief mean. So Ned is going to talk about her and her contributions as well. And we got to get Tom Ventura in here, too, before we bounce. They're probably the first horse probably in the ring at OBS. Back after this, Andy Serling.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 384-6-4-3.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Sirius XM Sports presents